You've heard me talk for years about the breakthrough health benefits of CBD. Now, our friends at CV Sciences have developed an innovative suite of non-CBD products that mimic CBD's healthful effects. CV Sciences' new Plus Health CBD-free line of gummies and capsules. The Plus Health Clarity gummies are packed with DMAE, lion's mane, and rhodiola designed to boost your cognitive performance, enhance memory, and provide natural energy. You need a little peace and calm? Plus Health's Peace Gummies, soothing blend of L-theanine, lemon balm, and St. John's wort supports serenity and relaxation without the drowsiness. And if you're on a journey towards optimal health, the Reshape capsules are packed with powerful ingredients like berberine and OEA to support metabolic health and help maintain healthy blood sugar levels. For more information and to order, head over to pluscbdoil.com/Hoffman. Use coupon code Hoffman30. For 30% off. That's pluscbdoil.com/Hoffman for the new Plus Health non-CBD collection. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. We're talking all things melatonin with Deanna Minnick. She is the author of a wonderful paper, very comprehensive review on the subject of melatonin, what it is, how it works, what it's good for, and potentially some ideas on how to take it. And so in part one, we talk all about different applications. In part two, I want to focus on some practicalities, you know, how to take it, when to take it, how much to take, but also address the elephant in the room, because there's a lot of articles, an example of which is yesterday's Wall Street Journal article on November 16th. Parents are giving kids melatonin to help them sleep. Doctors have concerns. And even more lurid headlines, melatonin poisonings in kids jump 530% in 10 years, according to MedPage. That's a publication for health professionals. And so, you know, it seems to me there's a little bit of an agenda behind this, which is to suggest that supplements are unregulated and we need to do something about it because melatonin is wreaking havoc. My conclusion is that, yes, there were reports to poison control, but, you know, sometimes parents get worried because there are a lot of melatonin gummies and candies out there, and then Junior gets into the stash and eats a bunch of them, and then parents freak out, although Junior seems fine, and they call poison control, and, you know, 99% of the time, it's all fine, you know, it's managed at home, maybe Junior takes a nap, but, you know, there's no dire consequences of that. However, there are some concerns about melatonin with kids, because as you point out in your article, kids make plenty of melatonin already. It's only in, you know, as we age or if we get sick that our melatonin production declines, right?
That's right. You know, in the article, there's the graph and it's showing that how, you know, like the first 3 months of life, melatonin levels are low. So typically if the child is breastfed, they're getting melatonin through the mother's milk. And then eventually it starts to go up pretty dramatically in young childhood. So those early formative years, our melatonin goes up and it's the highest it's ever going to be in our whole lives is when we're kids.
And now, we sleep a ton.
Right?
18 hours, right?
I remember that as well. Like, gosh, yeah, 10 to 12 hours. And my niece, who's eight, you know, same thing. She just sleeps. She's no problem with sleep whatsoever. But, you know, as we enter into puberty, those levels start to decline a little bit. You know, they're still relatively high, but then precipitously they start to drop decade by decade. So that by the time we're in our 50s, whereas that's where I'm at, you know, they're starting to really be bottomed out. They're not totally bottomed out, but then by the 60s and 70s, they're flatlined. So that tells me that, kids and all of these different media releases and CDC reports and such, you know, should we be punting over to melatonin supplements for kids that don't sleep? I don't think so. I don't personally like all of these gummy and chewable formats because I do think that it presents...
Yep, they're an attractive nuisance. Exactly. Yeah, they're enticing. Yeah.
They're very enticing. And what else is in there? So here's what I think. So I have been in the dietary supplement field for some time. And one of the things that comes to my mind from a formulation standpoint is how does that melatonin interact with that hygroscopic matrix of a gummy? Like, is that even stable? And you probably are aware. In fact, I think you reported on this on one of your other podcasts about how there was a Canadian study in which they took about 30 different products off the shelf.
Yeah.
And they found that they didn't meet label claim.
Yeah.
So they can have higher levels, like triple digit, high level percentages of melatonin. So what are we actually getting? Well,
they can underperform or they can overperform. I mean, that's the problem. It's not prescription medication. And some of the companies, frankly, are fly-by-night companies. The companies that you and I rely on when we prescribe to our patients generally
very
are pretty
different.
Scrupulous about assaying products to make sure of purity and potency. Well, purity is another issue because there are contaminants sometimes associated in melatonin products, right? And you can actually get too much of levels of serotonin, actually, which that's a whole different thing, right?
So you are so informed, and I'm so glad that you bring that up because that's something I didn't even realize until we did this paper. There is a different publication, which was published in Molecules in 2018, in which the authors detailed 13 different compounds that synthetic melatonin can be contaminated with potentially. And one of the things I also didn't realize was that 99% of the melatonin on the market is synthetic. And so what I even did, Ron, was I went away from the scientific literature and I started to look at the melatonin patents just to see how this stuff is made.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very eye-opening to see how, you know, starting with some kind of chemical compound and then all of these different reagents, many of them petrochemical derived, multiple steps, you know, adding to pollution. One of the things that article pointed out, the molecules, one that I mentioned, is the high degree of potential pollution of these, you know, just what is hewing out. So like, it may not be good for people, may not be good for the planet. And so that's where enter in my interest, which is plants. I'm a plant lover, you know, ever since graduate school studying carotenoids and working with Dr. Bland, doing lots of work on phytochemicals. So one of the things that really piqued my interest with melatonin was the phytomelatonin, the plant-based melatonin, because we tend to find melatonin in higher amounts in the reproductive parts of plants. Like
it's in foods. Seed. It's actually in a lot of vegetarian fruits.
In minute
amounts. So, right.
Very minute. Like we're talking nanogram, picogram amounts per gram. So, you know, you'd have to have like thousands of tart cherries to get a physiological dose.
Yeah.
But it's ubiquitous, which tells us that if it's redundant in nature, it's necessary. It's an ancestral molecule that I think has helped us in our ability to survive in our environment. But long story short, yes. Look, when you start doing the work on, okay, what's out there in terms of melatonin and all of the different sources, because I don't think most people realize that melatonin could be contaminated. It's synthetically derived, and that there's even an option for a plant cell matrix derived kind of melatonin. And there was another study, and we can go through this, where they compared head to head that plant cell matrix melatonin versus a synthetic melatonin. And the phytomelatonin outperformed the synthetic significantly, like in an anti-inflammatory activity, antioxidant, et cetera.
Now, you advise a lot of supplement companies, or have in the past. Are you recommending now that they source their melatonin from plant sources rather than the synthetic melatonin that's produced in a big chemical vat?
100%. Now, the only thing that is a little bit of a marketing thing that I think people need to get savvy on is that a phytomelatonin in the market could actually have a starter compound like corn, something corn derived, you know, something that would be called a vegetable or a plant. But then it's also subject to the same chemical processing that a synthetic melatonin would be subject to. So it's not,
that's a little bit of greenwashing kind of thing. You know, it's like it's sourced from plants, but it's still heavily chemically altered. Okay. Right.
Yeah. So I think, in the paper, I talked about phytomelatonin, and if it is not extracted, but just derived from the plant in its whole food form, you can get a lot of other things in there aside from the bioidentical melatonin. Like one of the things that, you know, my master's degree was on carotenoids. So, you know, there are 700 carotenoids in nature.
The colorful pigments in plants. Yeah.
Yes. They're what make plants pretty, you know, the red, the orange, the yellow, even some of the green. So one of the things that you can find in phytomelatonin, a specific one, at least that I can speak to, is beta carotene, lutein, and even zeaxanthin. And lutein and zeaxanthin.
Well, that's not too shabby. That's actually a beneficial additive.
And that will help to protect against blue light to the retina, right?
No.
Like, actually, like you're getting two things in one, you know.
It's like nature's blue blocker glasses, right? Which is...
Oh, that's good.
Right?
I think it's very good.
I'll share the trademark on that with you. That actually brings us to the point to discuss that as a lifestyle measure to enhance melatonin production, because, you know, there's a lot of talk about, you know, blue blocker glasses. Do they work? Nope. Do they make sense? Yep. Is there science behind that?
Yes, there is science behind it. We had to review that as part of this whole paper because, you know, it's talked about there out there on social media. Long story short, yes, they can protect from the light suppressive effects. So I do think that getting blue light blocking glasses is a good idea if you're going to be on a computer, at least to somewhat biohack your environment. Yeah. Now, the only thing is that
my iPad has a night setting, though. You know, there's a night setting that automatically kicks in. I've set it at 10 so that, you know, and because I tend to read, I read in bed. I know it's bad, but, you know, sleep hygiene, I have no problem. I have no problem falling asleep.
Yeah, it sounds like you sleep well. So
But at least I'm not getting a big dollop of blue light into my photoreceptors, which go to my pineal gland and suppress the melatonin right before bed. Right. So that's good.
Yeah. No, you're really helping your eyes. You know, in this day and age, I'm sure you've seen it, but there's so many ocular diseases and conditions happening now with eyes. And I think it's just people are on technology. They're on it for a long time and they're on it late at night. And this can be very damaging to the retina. So, you know, our eyes are part of our nervous system. I treasure my gift of sight. And, you know, it's just amazing to see all
these.
You are
a very visual person. And in addition to being a very prolific author, scientist, researcher, you're a wonderful artist and your artwork reflects your, I think you see science in color, you know, and in terms of.
You have sort of a
scientific synesthesia, you know, where I think your affinity for color matches your affinity for, you know, the science that underlies the colors in nature.
Well, thank you. Yes, I do think that color is a big deal. I think that color can be very healing, and color is all throughout nature. You know, getting that full spectrum light, which, you know, we see as sunlight, but it's really comprised of the rainbow variety of different wavelengths, right? And all of those wavelengths, I think, are helping us on many different levels. So if we just segment and we just have that blue light at night, you know, that's disruptive because that's not in congruence with again,
what our natural, sort of paleo sleep and paleo lifestyle. Coming back to the subject of kids, though, and I'm sorry to keep jumping around. So there is, however, and presumably you're a big fan of the Townsend Letter. I have in front of me one of my favorite columns from there, Dr. Alan Gabey's literature review and commentary.
Oh, yeah.
And he highlights an article there entitled Melatonin Improves Sleep in Children with Autism Spectrum Disorder. Now, maybe in principle, we don't want to, you know, just, you know, if you have a cranky kid, you just want to kind of shut them up, you know, just give them a big dollop of melatonin to knock them out, you know, like a knockout drop kind of thing. Because, you know, you want to watch Netflix and kids annoying you. That may be a frivolous use of melatonin. But if you've got a child with autism where they have very, very terrible circadian rhythm problems and, you know, they're up all night screaming sometimes and you want to do something to help without putting them on, you know, powerful sleep medications, you know, benzodiazepines, Xanax, Valium, you know, et cetera, do you think it's an option? Because what they're saying here, and this kind of goes to your principle of less is more, because you point that out of the article. They found that the lower dose, 1 milligram, was nearly as effective as the higher dose, 4 milligram.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Right?
Exactly. So you're calling out two different points that are really important. And one is that there may be indications for which to give melatonin supplements to children. There can be specific conditions. And two that we identify in the paper would be exactly what you're saying, autistic spectrum disorder and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD. Mm-hmm. So those two conditions may warrant melatonin supplementation in kids. So that's the first point. So it's not like we should just you know, just write it off entirely for the pediatric population. I do think that we can be safe, use good, high quality forms of melatonin for kids, and use it judiciously under certain timeframes, right? So that, you know, we can, they're not on it forever, right? Because we don't know about the long-term effects on puberty. And so
right.
that has
there may be developmental effects, because we know that in hormonal cancers, there seems to be a benefit as part of that benefit due to a hormonal impact. And for example, it's known that night shift nurses are more prone to breast cancer, and there may be a melatonin connection there. Well, if we, you know, maybe the effect is beneficial in adults, but maybe it has some ineffable, as yet undiscovered effects on childhood endocrine and reproductive development.
Correct. Yeah, we just don't know. We don't have that long-term data. So I would say to use it short-term, lowest dose, look for remediation of symptoms, use it under a healthcare practitioner's guidance so that it can be closely monitored. I think that that is, you know, we just have to be cautious with children, because we just don't know.
Right.
As far as the dose, though, I do want to speak to that, because we probably have a lot of clinicians listening as part of your audience. And I, you know, I think that the dose makes the poison, or the dose makes the healing happen. So when we look at some of the earlier studies done by Dr. Workman at MIT, you know, I consider him as part of this lineage of melatonin researchers who has really contributed a lot. There was a study that he was connected to way back, what was it, like early 2000s, like 2001, in which they did a study with multiple doses. They looked at 0.3 milligrams, they looked at 3 milligrams, and even 0.1 milligrams. And what they found out of each of those, the really low, the middle, or the high, is that the middle, the 0.3 milligrams, had the best data, had the best results from the people in the study. And if you look at the curve of melatonin and how it comes down, you know, as I mentioned, like in the 50s, it starts to bottom out. Having that repletion, much like we might be thinking about bioidentical hormone repletion in women going through perimenopause with estrogen, progesterone, we're looking at repletion. We're not looking at supraphysiological levels. We're just at repletion.
Yeah.
So, you know, seeking, going low, going slow, and shortest duration needed, unless, you know, if it is for aging, then obviously there's going to be a little bit more in terms of maintenance. But, you know, it's very interesting to me that, you know, more is not always better. We kind of get in our mind like, oh, wow, melatonin is everywhere. It's so important. And I can't imagine a life without melatonin. But, you know, perhaps you don't need as much as you might think you need. Mm-hmm. And of course, Ron, as you know, melatonin is subject to phase 1 and phase 2 metabolic detoxification. So there has to be a personalized element here, because some people, I know that you and Carolyn Gazella, I listened to your podcast with her on this, and, you know, really speaking to the paradoxical effect. Why do some people not get the same effect from melatonin? Mm-hmm. Well, I chalk that up.
Some people get a backwards effect. You know, they actually, it activates them, or they fall asleep for a while and then they wake up like a shot. You know, they can't sleep anymore.
You know, and you know, here's my theory on that. We know that most of melatonin goes through cytochrome P450-1A2, which is the same phase 1 enzyme that caffeine goes through. So people, this is my theory.
Yeah, but it differs from person to person. Yeah, right.
It differs from person to person. And, you know, if you're a person who could drink coffee late at night and, you know, you can have a double espresso and you get no effect from that, you can go right to sleep, you might be a fast metabolizer of melatonin, which means that you really need to monitor when you take your dose, because levels peak within that 30 to 60 minute window, you know, average time 41 minutes. Mm-hmm. But essentially, you may need to take it closer to bedtime, because as you rapidly metabolize it, you may also need a different dose. So it just kind of depends on the kinetics. It may also depend on what you eat before bedtime. You know, there could be a lot of different factors, but we can't forget that melatonin, much like other hormones, is subject to metabolic detoxification, which is under the control of personalized gene variants.
And even influenced by the medications you're taking, because medications impact, there's drug-nutrient interactions. Some medications accelerate the detox. I think it's grapefruit slows the detox, that pathway. Whereas there are other things that accelerate and in women, it may be that the detoxification of estrogen gets in the way of the detoxification of melatonin. They have higher levels for longer. I mean, I'm just speculating here.
Well, we do know that phase one and phase two, so when it goes to phase one, so it goes through primarily 1A2, but then there's also 1A1, 1B1, and 1B1 is the one enzyme that does metabolize estrogen and hydroxylates estrogen. It's also sulfated as part of phase two. So sulfur is a main conjugate of, you know, kind of that whole pathway. And that is also shared by some of the other hormones. So to your point, which is valid, like if you have a high hormone load, it may require more in the way of facilitating movement through these pathways. And there could be some implications.
Can you send me a chip with that information that I can insert into my brain? Because
in the paper, we looked a bit more at contraindications. We even looked at combinations with certain nutrients. Like one of the things that I learned is like having vitamin C with melatonin seems to be a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Seems to be a good thing, right? So there's a certain amount of studies looking at some combinations like glutathione.
Synergy versus antagonism, in other words.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So what about the time-release products? Does that make any sense for some people? Because intuitively it seems to make sense, because if melatonin is short-acting, you want it to act throughout the night. And a lot of people don't have so much trouble falling asleep. It's that they have early morning wake up and then they, you know, toss and turn at like, 3 in the morning and they can't get adequate sleep. Is there any information on the efficacy of those time release formulas?
I think it's plausible in terms of delaying some of the activity or at least extending it through the night in a more balanced way for certain individuals that are maybe fast metabolizers or may have this paradoxical effect. The only downside I see of time release is what is making it release in a more delayed fashion. Mm-hmm. Like many times there are phthalates, parabens, mm-hmm. certain things added to
waxes,
that concoction that
like
I don't always love.
Yeah.
So I just think about that. And again, this has to be in part of that, you know, it might be just regulating the dose to be even lower, or even, you know, just changing that up a little bit. But, you know, there could be a case for time release in certain cases. It's just I often query, what is added to it to make it time release. I don't like a lot of those agents. Some of them mm-hmm. can be toxic.
And one person's time release may be another person's
accelerated release.
People have different transit times. People have different digestive abilities.
That's right.
I'm not sure how they get it right for, you know, like one size fits all. Worst case scenario is that somebody swallows the pill and it goes clink in the toilet and, you know, none of it gets released.
That's right. So having some kind of a plant cell matrix kind of embedded material might allow for a more delayed release and a more natural release. You know, some of those time release formulations, based on what I know about formulation, is sometimes they require stomach acid mm-hmm. in order to change the dynamics. And if you think if you're taking this right before bedtime, how much stomach acid will you have? Because, you know, typically the acid is released with a meal, right? So I don't know. There are just a lot of different variables as it relates to that sustained or time release. I'm not discounting it completely, but I just think that there's more underneath the hood of looking into those.
And I wanted to ask you a question because, as you mentioned, you know, I'm traveling a lot these days, and I plan to take a trip to Lithuania, which we talked a little bit about. There's some Lithuanian ancestry as well. And, you know, it's kind of ancestry tour, you know, to kind of look at the place of my origins. It's a 6-hour plane trip. And, you know, it's controversial as to whether melatonin really is efficacious against jet lag, and it seems to make a difference whether you go east or whether you go west. I get kind of discombobulated, especially as I get older. It's harder to adapt. You know, that first day is kind of murder. Is there something about the timing of melatonin? Should I begin taking it before the trip, during the flight? Should I take it to anticipate the time at my destination 6 hours later? What does the science say on that?
Yeah. So what you want to do, let's imagine you're going from New York to Lithuania is, especially that's more than 3 time zones, right? So there can really be some circadian
rhythm. 5 or 6. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So, when you get to that to Lithuania, to stay awake as long as you can until it gets to bedtime, and then to take a dose of melatonin that is in the neighborhood between 3 and 6 milligrams. Mm-hmm. You know, something, I don't know your kinetics, but I'm just giving you a general range. Like this right. is much
so
higher.
A little higher dose than you might ordinarily use. Okay.
That's right. That's mm-hmm. right. We're not doing repletion here. We're doing like a reset, like we're pushing a big button, a reset yeah. biochemically to get you on that Lithuanian circadian.
Right, right.
So you need more for that typically. So you would take it right before bedtime mm-hmm. In hopefully within about 3 days. Like if you did that for 3 consecutive days upon being there in Lithuania, mm-hmm. it should shake out as being, you know, where you can equilibrate
then,
better.
Then maybe I can revert to my normal dose, which is like 1 to 3.
Yeah, yeah. And then to come down to your regular dose. That's mm-hmm. right. That's mm-hmm. right. But, you know, to take it once you're actually there on site and right before bedtime, when you actually want mm-hmm. that to be seen by the pineal gland and kind of you want that impetus, right? You're not going right. to take it when it's broad daylight. You'd have to wait. You know, and I traveled extensively even with Dr. Jeff Bland. And I, you know, he really taught me like just you got to forge forward in that time zone
yeah,
as best.
I know. It's hard.
Arrive when it's light and it's really your nighttime, the more you just have to push yourself as best you can. That'll just reset. Rhythm.
I always try to do that. But man, that first day is kind of murder because I'm walking
it's
around
hard.
Like a
it's
zombie.
Hard. Yeah.
And I'm waiting for, you know, the first opportunity to go to sleep after a rough plane flight. And yeah, but that's the idea is that you don't want to
keep
you
yourself
know,
busy.
Yeah,
keep
exactly.
yourself busy
exactly.
during that time. And then exactly. just have your melatonin 3 to 6 grams. It sounds like you're on the higher side, so probably that 6 milligrams mm-hmm. before mm-hmm. bedtime.
Does it work going west? Yeah. Or does it pay to take it going west? Because I think the research is more robust on advancing the time when you go to a later time zone, I think.
That's
yeah.
correct. If you're traveling east or you go over 3 to 5 time zones, typically it's best. But mm-hmm. You know, gauge for yourself. I mean, I just got back from Cyprus and I, you know, coming back west, I did it. It did take me a little bit of, I don't know, it just feels different like when I'm going to travel to mm-hmm. a place versus coming home. When I'm coming right. home, I kind of feel like I can be a little bit, you know, looser about my sleep regimen and such. So it just depends on personal preference. But yes, much of the studies, and in fact, there was a Cochrane review that looked at a number of trials. And they did look at traveling east.
And they're very conservative. They're very skeptical. They're you know,
that's
generally
right.
dismissive
are.
Of a lot of therapies, yeah. even you know, skeptical of things like statins and PSAs. So they're not all in on a lot of things that are popular.
That's right. Yeah. No, that's true. So hopefully you'll have an easy time accommodating to the Lithuanian time zone.
Indeed. And finally, what I really like about your paper is that you talk not just about, you know, taking a pill, because this is an appealing paradigm for a lot of people is, you know, sleeping pills. You know, I reach for something and, you know, take a pill if you have an ill. But you talk about a melatonin lifestyle and you actually create kind of a pyramid like the food pyramid. And the base of the pyramid is based on exercise, proper diet. And then, you know, you talk a little bit about light exposure and sleep hygiene. And the apex of the pyramid, the top, you know, sort of reserved as a kind of a last resort, is taking melatonin, right?
That's right. I mean, you know, just like you said, Zeitgebers, you know, what sets time throughout our day? It's physical activity, it's meals, it's light exposure. So we need those time setters throughout the day. And if we don't have those, how do we override that massive signal just with supplemental melatonin all the time? I think we have to look deeper at the root cause. We need to be looking at our diets, you know, even those blue light protective nutrients, like I was talking about, lutein, zeaxanthin. So eating more plants, especially the green, yellow variety, getting protein, you know, and just examining the light quality, you know, so it's going into the darker months here where I live in the Pacific Northwest, just like it is for you. Yep. And, you know, I've even been evaluating the lights.
That's where Starbucks light. Started. That's where, and there's a good reason for that.
That's right. That's yeah. right. All the darkness, the gloominess.
Yeah.
I actually do quite well with it. I mean, maybe I'm a just naturally high melatonin producer.
Well,
you're
part Lithuanian, so that's that may be one. You're a creature of the darkness from the Baltic
I'm
regions.
A creature of the darkness. I get most of my creative inspiration in the dark. Maybe melatonin yeah. supplementation. The melatonin in the body is, you know, connected to creativity. I don't know, but that's when I get a lot of my inspiration too.
Mm-hmm. Well, the pineal is the third eye after all, so maybe there's something to it.
You got it. Rene Descartes, seat of the soul is what he called the pineal gland.
Well, he almost nailed it. It's actually the seat of melatonin production, but close, no cigar. So, we could go on and on about this, but I refer people to your article, you know, if you're a health professional, especially, it's a great article, and it appears in the journal Nutrients, right?
Nutrient, yeah.
And so it's entitled, Is Melatonin the Next Vitamin D? Review of Emerging Science, Clinical Uses, Safety, and Dietary Supplements. You're the lead author, along with some people I know, including Dr. Corey Schuler. So congratulations to you on that article. And so more resources, you know, you got a lot of ways that people can find out more about you and about your works, some wonderful books. Tell us about those briefly.
Well, you know, my website is deannaminick.com, and I think that's the hub for everything. My
Let's
social
spell it.
Media.
It's M-I-N-I-C-H.
You got it. So it's okay. Deanna, deannaminick.com. So it's just my name. And then, you know, the article, I wrote it with clinicians in mind because there's no sense of just publishing on science for science sake without having that translation is how I see it. At least that's what I feel like I can contribute. So the article, you know, we even paid to make it open access for people. A lot of science is locked up.
Yeah.
So I wanted it to be available.
I hate those paywalls. You know, I hate the paywalls.
There are paywalls. And, you know, science to me is like, that's public health knowledge. Like, we need to get that out. So anyway, it's available to clinicians. Please access it. You know, we created so many tables and graphics, and I just was trying to figure out, like, okay, we need to make this digestible for everybody. So give us feedback. Email me if you want at deanna@deannaminick.com. Happy to see what your questions are, see if I can't help. But that's how to find me.
What are your books for the public? Because they're very user-friendly and they're great primers on nutrition.
Yeah, thanks. So yes, I do have a number of books, and one of them is called Whole Detox, like W-H-O-L-E, like the whole self, looking at a very holistic approach. And basically, it's just it's a 21-day program to have more color in one's diet for a variety of different reasons, psychological and physiological. And then I have another book called The Rainbow Diet. I have a bunch of other books. I have a total of six, but those are my
I think The Rainbow Diet
books.
Is really your signature work, and it's beautifully illustrated,
too. The Rainbow
Diet.
Yeah. It's very funny. Some people even call me like the rainbow doctor. Mm-hmm. Rainbow is kind of like my thing. Even my Instagram is all rainbow-fied. Yeah, color is, you know, back to what you were saying. I mean, color is a powerful way that we connect through nature and we become inspired. And I feel like, you know, knowledge is good, but when we marry that with inspiration, it holds, you know, and we can create some significant behavior change.
Mm-hmm. And it certainly offers us a teachable moment about the relationship between nature and science. So, yeah, good stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Great discussion. Really appreciate it. Thank you very much, Deanna, for, you know, sharing some of your valuable time with us. And we'll meet again on the conference circuit. I'll tell you all about Lithuania.
You'll be at IHS?
I will be. Yes. Oh, you're coming to New York. So great. Yeah. For our health practitioners, big conference coming up at the end of February. It's traditional in New York, sort of in that coldest, darkest time of the year, where melatonin levels surge. You're going to be speaking at the Integrative Health Symposium, IHS, February, New York City. It's kind of a signature event for New York in the field of integrated medicine. So great. I'm looking forward to your talk. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I want to thank you for listening to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or your favorite podcast app, and get new episodes automatically downloaded every weekday. And please give us a rating and review. It truly helps new people discover Intelligent Medicine. The Intelligent Medicine Podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional healthcare services, including the giving of medical advice, and no doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of information on this podcast or materials linked from this podcast is at the user's own risk. The content of this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not disregard or delay in obtaining medical advice for any medical condition they may have, and should seek the assistance of their healthcare professionals for any such conditions. Finally, please visit drhoffman.com and discover everything Intelligent Medicine has to offer, including frequently updated, unbiased health news
and fully vetted product and supplement recommendations. You're listening to Intelligent Medicine, a resource to help you take control of your health. We offer a balanced, objective analysis of all your health, wellness, and aging options, both conventional and alternative. Now you can take your engagement to the next level by joining FullScript. FullScript is my online dispensing platform that only offers curated, professional-grade supplement brands that I know and trust. Never counterfeit or expired, always stored and shipped correctly. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com for more information and to start your free FullScript account. Buying through FullScript offers fast shipping, optional refill reminders, a mobile-friendly site. It's safe, secure, and HIPAA compliant and offers world-class support. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com. You'll get access to the supplements and features you need to help you achieve your wellness goals, including my custom targeted protocols that combine the products I recommend to address specific needs, heart health, immune support, and much more. It's all at DearHoffmanStore.com. DearHoffmanStore.com.